TFM.
Welcome, Stargazers, to another episode of The Artificial Tango, our dedicated Star Trek Picard podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, I have to say, I never realized that a batleth was so heavy.
Oh, Chris, I'm so sorry. I meant to warn you, but yes, you do need to be doing some serious upper body workouts to be able to use it. I apologize for not letting you know that ahead of time. But yes, as anyone could tell, it sees a picture of me. I of course, never skip arm day or back day. And so I can use said batleth. And it's just not for everyone.
All right. I'm just glad that Arm Day was not the holiday that the changelings and the Borg targeted to defeat the Federation, because I'm just picturing what would have been going on Arm Day and the plan and the fact that some of these Borg maybe needed a new arm. Changelings wanted to get better at doing arms.
Yeah.
It would have been wonderful.
Really, it would have just been weird because they would have come in and there's just a lot of arm wrestling competitions that are held all over the Federation then. And of course, you know, arm workout, lots of people, you know, using weights and doing curls and stuff. It's kind of an awkward day, all right. In all honesty.
It sounds like a very awkward day, and it's one that I'm surprised is not canon yet.
And you know what's best about it, Chris, is that you get to see the wonderful 25th century workout attire that people have. Troy and Crusher love to bring that back out.
It's kind of retro, right? You know, it's like this, the style is a throwback. It's about 30 years ago. It's coming back into style.
Exactly. It's fantastic. It's fantastic. Everybody should enjoy Arm Day.
All right, everyone. I don't know how we got off on Arm Day. That was an unexpected little detour for us, but we're gonna. I guess it's just because swords are fun, and
swords
I had
are
to
fun.
Bring up
yes.
the batleth, and then there we go, down one of our rabbit holes or targ holes, or whatever you want to call them. But we're gonna finish up the discussion of season 3 of Star Trek Picard today with The Last Generation. It's the final episode, not only of season 3. Not only of Star Trek Picard, but quite possibly of the Enterprise D crew saving the galaxy together. So, Matthew, how are you feeling? We've reached the end of this story.
You know what? I'm feeling a damn sight better than I did coming out of Nemesis. So this series has got that going for it.
It's a different kind of feeling, Matthew.
Yeah, exactly. definitely pardon my French there, but it's just, I couldn't think of a better way to say that, because, you know, I think I've even mentioned many times over the years that we've been podcasting together, you know, Nemesis was such a travesty for me. I really did not like the movie. I'll be interested to kind of go back and rewatch it. We're, you know, planning on covering the films now that they're all in 4K and everything sometime soon. But
it's grown on me over the years, but it's certainly not, it's probably my least favorite of all the Star Trek films.
Yeah.
But
it's understandable. We'll see. Yeah. So I've usually had it at the bottom of my list as well. So yes, I mean, for me, coming out of this season, I tweeted out to Terry Metalis and the crew of the Enterprise and those involved just a heartfelt thank you, really, because, you know, this series did something that I just absolutely was not expecting, and it was to rekindle my love for Star Trek in a way that I didn't think possible. I did enjoy Strange New Worlds. I thought that was great. And I've enjoyed Lower Decks for the most part, except for Peanut Hamper, the worst character ever created for Star Trek ever.
I'm not a fan of Peanut Hamper either.
So, but to me, this was just an incredible season of Star Trek television. And the reason it was, we've talked about it before, you're respecting the past and honoring it. And at the same time, forging a future that I'm hoping happens.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if I came into this series thinking, oh, I need, you know, a spinoff of this. But very quickly, this season led me to think, oh, no, I need what comes next. That's really how I'm feeling, which I think, in all honesty, means that this series is lights out a success.
Yeah. Yeah, the feeling of do we need a spinoff going into it is an interesting one, because I'm just thinking back to Discovery season two, when Pike comes aboard and then Spock comes into the story. And as the season went along, lots of us started feeling like, I really hope they do a spinoff. I really want a series with Pike and Spock and Number One and the early days of the Enterprise, and we got it. And going into the season, I had not thought about the prospect of some sort of spinoff from Discovery. And I think this season is the same. Going into the season, I didn't even think about the idea of spinning off the story that we're going to get. I thought, of course, that there will be more Star Trek series coming up. But would a new series grow directly out of the events of this season? I didn't really think about that as being part of how they would approach it.
Right.
But, well, except I thought maybe Seven and Raffi would get a series. Somehow that would grow out of the story. I did think about that. But what we've actually gotten here, and the idea of having Jean-Luc and Beverly's son being an ensign on the Enterprise G or any ship, is not something that I had considered. But I'll say that it grew naturally out of the story, although to say that is kind of weird, because you can write the story so that it grows out of the story.
Right.
So it's not necessarily like it organically grew out of it. It feels very much like this story, especially the final phases of the story, were designed to set up a spinoff series.
Yeah. No, I mean, I agree with you. And I think one of the things that, you know, Metallus had talked about in an interview there for Variety, he said, you know, that for him, this season, the season's all over, right? And so, but he felt that it was a very important, in a fanboy sense for him, he wanted all the action figures to be placed neatly back on the shelf when they were done.
Right.
And so that if you, you know, left this show, you knew that, you know, as he said, the Enterprise D is not crashed, but in a museum. There's a bright future for Star Trek and their families, these characters that for the next generation we had come to know and love. And I think, you know, again, not to dog Nemesis, but that's the thing that that movie doesn't really do, is that because Stuart Baird wouldn't play to the strengths of the Star Trek story, and which is caring about the characters, you lost that. And Metallus totally understands that, yes, this is about the crew of the next generation, but it also feels like it's a setup for the next generation. I think there's a beauty to that, because there's something about Star Trek which is about this perpetuation of the idea that the future, there can be hope in it, right? And part of that is passing on a legacy to the next generation that they then carry on. And of course, that's what this whole season has been about. So to me, it's 100%. Again, successful in doing exactly what Metallus has talked about that his desires were for this show. And to me, that's it. It makes it a complete success then, because it's doing exactly what the creator wanted it to do.
Going back to what you said earlier, when you're comparing how this season of Picard made you feel and how you felt about Strange New Worlds, I think the difference there, because if anyone listens to you and me on Saddle Up, where we talk about Strange New Worlds, they will know that we really loved the first season of that show and what it was doing with Star Trek and how it was bringing us back to the type of Star Trek storytelling and messaging and such that is why we love Star Trek in the first place.
Right.
I think the difference between that and this season of Picard is that we are so invested in these characters from the next generation, whereas the characters on Strange New Worlds are characters that we're getting to know. Of course, we know Spock, but this is a different incarnation of Spock. And Pike, we didn't know that much about until season two of Discovery. And then most of the rest of the characters on that show are new for us. Right. You know, I mean, Uhura is a very young Uhura that we don't know, and she's not the Uhura that we've come to know and love over the years. And I think that's just the big difference, is that here, it's like what Terry was doing himself, is that these are characters that we've known, many of us, for, depending on how old you are, maybe most of your life.
Yeah.
For me, The Next Generation premiered when I was near the end of high school, but from that point on, these characters have always been part of my life.
Right.
So there's like a secret seasoning in this season of Star Trek that enhances it for us in a way that hasn't been possible with the other Star Trek that's been made in recent years.
Well, and I think too, you know, we talked about the way in which that season of Strange New Worlds had really kind of mirrored older seasons of Star Trek, especially. And I think it really mirrors Enterprise the most, in the sense of there is a through line of stories that are happening for the characters, but they are also one-off adventures that are happening throughout the season. Whereas this specifically was meant to be a 10-part movie to send off this crew in the way that it was meant to. And I think what's interesting about that is, in many ways, you know, Metalis realized that for TOS fans, you know, you had been given six films to send off the original series crew. And
the final film put a nice bow on everything for them.
Yes. Well, and when you think about it, all of those films are 2 hours, right? So you've got a 12-hour marathon that you can do that gives you the, you know, the end of their stories. And so that's exactly what we're doing here. So I think that's one of the reasons that the arced nature of the season also works, because it's specifically meant to be that. And again, I think the particulars are what they are on the season, and we're going to talk all about them in just a second. But I think that, again, because Metalis was able to do exactly what he wanted, and I think do it in a way that has made, I would say, 99% of the Star Trek fandom happy, this is an utter success. Like, there, I don't know if there has been a success in Star Trek this way since maybe the end of Deep Space Nine, and that whole season leading up to that 7-part arc for the end, right? I don't think that Star Trek has recaptured that type of success in storytelling, where fans were left just wanting more, especially of a crew in their story in that way. So, yeah, I mean, it that obviously shows my bias against, you know, I think Voyager, and I think Enterprise's fourth season was phenomenal, and of course, until they ruined it in the end with a really terrible last episode. Yeah, exactly. But and again, I thought that was a great last season. But when it comes to absolute success and pulling exactly what you want off as the creatives, and you know, us having read The Companion, we know so much about what they were wanting to do on Deep Space Nine. They nailed it, right? And so I think, again, this that type of storytelling success hasn't been seen till this season. And it's really impressive, if you ask me.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're a bit biased in the way that I do think that the fan reaction to this season, it has gotten the boost from the nostalgia, because there's so much stuff in here that if it were done in a different context, I'm not sure it would be as well received. But because it's this crew, it's this cast, it's this ship, the Enterprise D, it's all this stuff that we love, we are embracing it with so much joy that it really, I think, makes the story work. Whereas if this were a general story and you look at some of the parts of it, you might feel like it doesn't really hold together at all times. There's a lot of
right
stuff that goes on that's doesn't really make sense if you examine it, but it's there to make the next part of the story work or to move us to this point or that point. But it's, for me, it's all stuff that I'm happy to overlook and just enjoy the ride. And mm-hmm. I think that's one additional reason why this season has been so over the top wonderful for so many fans, but also why I do see some fans nitpicking little things about the story. Most of those fans tend to be people who do that all the time, though, mm-hmm. I've noticed.
You know, I think... So, Matalas had, I think, a fantastic view on this idea, which is when you think about, especially people who get into their 30s, 40s, 50s, and onward, right? When you have these people whose lives are so indelibly linked to important events, when you get together with old friends, what do? You reminisce about the past. And Matalas talked a lot about this in this interview he did. I think it was for Variety. And I, you know, so in many ways, referencing the past or talking about the past or bringing up the past or, you know, mm-hmm. right? Like, this is what we do as human beings mm-hmm. because yeah. it's a remembrance. And it's not about the nostalgia. It's just about those things in the past connect us. And we're going to talk about that more, I think. But that's where I we have this really kitschy word to talk about this, and we call it nostalgia. Mm-hmm. But I don't necessarily think that that's what this is for nostalgia's sake, because all of these things are connected to these characters that mm-hmm. we are. Yeah. Absolutely. And so because
that's one reason the story does work.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And so I just wanted to bring that up because I think, yes, you could, if you were, I think just being super cynical, you could absolutely, you know, knock this season for the idea of it being nothing but nostalgia. But the reason it's full of the past of Star Trek is because it's about these characters who are so indelibly linked to the past of Star Trek. And yet, mm-hmm. again, as we mentioned, the beauty is that we're not just doing the past for the past's sake. We're actually doing this because Matalas has built into this a future.
Well, that's something this story did really well, is that it balanced that creation of a future with looking back at the past. And it's also not just that the characters have this indelible link to the past, as you just said, but it's also that they have that indelible link to one another. And that's right. why the relationships that we see
yes.
work yeah. so well. And I think it was a wonderful idea to, and maybe this is a point where we can transition to talking to Jack a little bit, but I think it was a wonderful idea to leverage the Beverly-Picard relationship that never really happened for us on the screen and have them have a child together that we didn't know about, and then have that child be the center of the story that brings everyone back together, that
right.
writes the final chapter for a long-running Star Trek storyline with the Borg.
Yep.
But also gives us a new person to explore the Star Trek universe with
right.
in the form of Ensign Jack Crusher.
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea of this show coming to this triumvirate that we never knew existed until now of Picard, Beverly, and Jack, and seeing them here have to do whatever they can to try and save their son, but also the children of countless others, right? So their son is not the only one who's in danger. Mm-hmm. Everyone is in danger, the entire galaxy at this point. And so to put Beverly and Picard in that situation and them having had this strained relationship and having to work through that together and then work through this trying to find a solution to save their child is phenomenal. And I think the beauty of that, and one of the things that really struck me, and I'm not a parent, but I know many parents, and I've watched many people raise their children, and I'm watching friends right now raise their children, and a lot of the struggles that many parents run into, my parents did as well because of me, which is that, you know, you can do everything you can to raise your children, quote unquote, right. Mm-hmm. And that child can still choose the wrong path. And, you know, what's interesting to me is that this story really becomes that proverb which says, you know, raise up a child in the way he should go, and when he's old, he will not depart from it. So this is exactly the story we get here, because the heartache of a parent who's watching their child go down a path that that parent knows is not going to bring them joy or happiness or peace or any of those things because of your experience as a parent is something that I've watched many people go through. And having been the person who was on the other side of that, being the child making those choices and then coming out the other side like Jack does here, I think it's a really beautiful and really well done story that they've allowed these three characters to play out. And it's very clear here that Terry is a parent, you know, who has these, I'm sure, same type of feelings of you're doing everything you can to raise your children well, and you're just praying to God that they turn out well and make the right choices.
Mm-hmm. Right. And in this situation, beyond what you're describing in terms of parenting and then your child going down a different path and a path that you know is not going to be good for them. In this situation, Beverly's watching this and Jack is going down this path. There are a couple of aspects to it. One, he's going down this path against his will. Like, he's not really making the decision to go down this path. He's being pulled to the Borg because of his biology.
I might say, at least the way I felt that this episode is that, you know, Jack has to make the choice himself to come out.
Well, that's
the
second part of it.
Right. Yeah, and so I would say that it's a pull of the biology that the Borg have been able to propagate in him. Mm-hmm. But it's also a personal pull, because Picard even says, you long for the connection that I long for. In fact, one of the struggles that I passed on to you was this feeling of being disconnected and feeling different and not really knowing how to let people in. And that fear, you know, keeping you closed off from everyone. And so it's an interesting sense that there's a biological pull from the Borg. Mm-hmm. There's a biological pull from the things that Picard has passed on that have nothing to do with the Borg. And I find that to be the more I think about it, the writing gets better and better in that sense, because it's not just a Borg thing. It is this thing that we've watched Jean-Luc suffer with for 35 years and more, that we have the next generation, right?
Right. Yeah. But for Jack, what's going on with him from when we first meet him to the end is not completely his own decision making. Whereas, like, if you raise your child, human parents, we raise our children, and if our children go off in a direction that we know is wrong for them, it's going to be destructive for them, they're making that choice themselves. Someone might be influencing them. Someone might be pulling them that way, but they're making that decision. Mm-hmm. Whereas with Jack, there was something else calling out to him. There was something besides the voice. There was probably something innate that we couldn't see, he couldn't see or feel. It's just something instinctual pulling him ultimately back to the Borg Queen. And Beverly's watching that. And because of the history with the Borg, she knows that something is pulling him in that way as well. Right. It's not purely like she raised him in one way and then he rejected that and went off in another direction. So that has to be very painful for her as yeah. well. And especially for Jean-Luc, knowing that whatever that is that's happening, once they know that the Borg have implanted mm-hmm. something, Jean-Luc knows that he passed that on to Jack and therefore he is responsible. And then you said that the writing gets even better if you really start thinking about this. And yeah, it's very much the case when Jean-Luc goes to the cube and plugs himself in and embraces Jack. And then we have that dialogue between the two of them. It is at that point where you have the other biological influence. The Borg Queen may see herself as Jack's mother, but Jean-Luc is Jack's father.
Right.
And through the conversation that they have, Jack is able to come back over to reject the Borg and come back over to Jean-Luc. So there is a lot of complexity in the different people who mm-hmm. are involved and their influences on Jack and then Jack's origin and then Jack himself.
Well, and I think that, you know, something we talked a great deal about last week and I think has a big impact on this story is the way in which the undertone and thematic element of the idea of an entire generation being pulled by influences like social media and all those things mm-hmm. to get inside their heads in a way that becomes that influence, right? We even call people on social media influencers. And that is because mm-hmm. there's a vast amount of research in this, in the ways in which social media has an incredible ability to make somebody turn on a dime. And it seems like a dime, but it can take just months, right, for this to happen, mm-hmm. for people to be so sucked into certain ideas. And it's not just the younger generation, it's the older generation too. We're seeing it across the board,
oh,
right?
Oh, sure.
And yeah. so I think
in some cases, it's very much the older generation.
Exactly.
That gets sucked into some of that stuff.
Also the younger generation as well. No one is mm-hmm. immune from it. And we're seeing that sure. in a variety of different ways. And it's playing itself out differently in each generation, but it's still happening to each generation. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, that's such a key part of this as well. And I do really appreciate that, as we mentioned last week, the fact that this is so prescient as a point for mm-hmm. where we are just right now is really mm-hmm. important. But I think, you know, it's also a theme that goes all the way back through literature to, say, like 1984 and these other things where we see mm-hmm. the ways in which society gets captured by something and then turns and mm-hmm. becomes something completely, you know, unbeknownst to us. Like, we're like, how did that happen? Well, this is how it mm-hmm. happened, you know? So, I mean, we're really talking about a lot of, I think, very important ideas here in this season. And, you know, the more layers you peel back, the more you get. And that's one of the things mm-hmm. that I've really appreciated about, especially even just the end of the season here.
Yeah, that's an important thing about the season, because knowing the ending now, when you go back and watch, of course, it'll be fun to go back and watch for clues that you didn't pick up on the first time. But you might feel like, well, I know how it ends, so it's just going to be fun to rewatch. But actually, I do think that there's so much here that went unnoticed because yeah. all eyes were on things like the recreation of the Enterprise bridge,
exactly.
or every tiny reference to Voyager, DS9, Next Generation, whatever, whether it was spoken or visual. There was so much eye candy in
right.
this season that I think there is a lot of depth in the writing that mm-hmm. went unnoticed. And even though we've dug into it as well, like, I'm sure we're going to find stuff that we didn't pick up on or didn't discuss as we go back through it.
Yeah, I think, too, one of the things that ties into this, you know, and Jack it says to Picard that, you know, this place is perfect. There's no pain. There's no hurt here. Mm-hmm. And I think the beauty of the season, tying into all the things we've been discussing, was the way in which we are watching, I think, especially a younger generation, look for connection and acceptance and perfection. Mm-hmm. And I put that in quotes. And they're willing to accept lies to do it. The ways in which we're willing and the things we're willing to do to ourselves to try and find what we think is missing and how dangerous it is, right? And mm-hmm. I think Jack here obviously is somebody who's willing to change every single part about him to accept this lie that what he's found is perfection. And as Picard calls it, there's this euphoric feeling that comes with this, but it's really mm-hmm. a lie. It's not actually the truth. And well, so I really love that.
Yeah. And actually that scene mirrors Jean-Luc's own experience when he was in the Nexus in Generations, and he quickly pulled himself out of that mm-hmm. with the help of Guinan, of course. But it's similar. I didn't think about it until right now, but it's similar to that scene for Jean-Luc, what Jack is going through here. Yeah. About the young generation and what this story is or isn't saying about them, what is the message here? I've seen a number of fans ask a legitimate question, which is, why does the modified Borg DNA only activate in people who are 25 or younger? Mm-hmm. And you and I discussed last time, you know, it's not going to be the same for every alien species, but just to make it something you can grasp in storytelling, keep it simple, age 25 here. The beginning of this episode really reinforced to me the idea that there is a message in this season about what is happening, I would say, with discourse in society and how it's being driven by a younger generation that often lacks the life experience to have a fully, like a well-rounded view and message in what's being discussed. And it's just at the very beginning of this episode where we've got the broadcast mirroring Star Trek IV, where in this case we've got Pavel Chekhov's son, Anton Chekhov, lovingly named, I'm sure, after Anton Yelkin.
Yes, absolutely.
Who unfortunately died and played Chekhov in the JJ films. But the message was, this is President Anton Chekhov of the United Federation of Planets, broadcasting on all emergency channels. Do not approach Earth. A signal of unknown origin has turned our young against us. And then, of course, the message goes on from there. But it was just that portion of has turned our young against us, because I do think sometimes in society these days, it feels like there is a battle forming between generations in a way that I feel we haven't seen in the past. And I, of course, have only lived 50 years myself, so I don't know centuries ago what kind of generational battles there were, but I just do know that in my lifetime, it feels like there's a bit more of a rift than there has been in the past. And I do feel social media discourse is responsible mm-hmm. for a lot of that, and news media is responsible for a lot of that, because, you know, editors are writing headlines in ways that are designed to separate people into groups and pit people against one another, and people don't read the details anymore. And so that just stood out to me here, and it feels like at the end of this, when the Borg cube is destroyed, I loved that, and Jeri Ryan played this so well, I loved that there was restraint from the Starfleet officers who were not Borgified yet, as the young people were retaking the bridge, and there was a restraint, and as soon as they came back to who they were, Seven just hugs Sydney. It's okay, it's over now. And I thought that also showed this recognition that if you can cast aside whatever is controlling or influencing people to break off into these groups and to be fighting one another so often, you remember that we're all in this together. Right. We're all the same. We're all humans. We might not agree on the details of everything, but most of us, the vast, vast majority of everyone, ultimately wants what's best and wants to live happy lives and take care of their children and take care of each other and have friends and enjoy the very short time that we have in this world. And I thought that came through at the end. It did for me in this story. And it's another way that I feel that this story talks so much about family and direct family, biological family, blood relations and such, but it also talks about the bigger family of, I'm going to use the word humans. I know they're not all humans, but just everyone involved, you know, in Starfleet and the Federation here.
Yeah, I think one of the things that really sticks out to me, you know, this idea of capturing the hearts of youth is, in all honesty, when you look back at history, the way to make massive changes in societies is to capture the youth and divorce mm-hmm. them from the past, which means divorcing mm-hmm. them from their families, from their parents. And the reason you're able to do that is because our brains are very impressionable as we grow. So what mm-hmm. we are taught and how we are taught it and all of these things has a massive impact on how we turn out. This is why the battle for every generation is so important. This is why parents are so important. Like you were saying, this is why families are so important. And I think that's what this whole season has been about. On top of that, I think, you know, it really comes down to true connection comes from true love, which is always sacrificial and unconditional. And neither of these things can come by force. They're gifts that we give to one another. And that's exactly what wins Jack over, is Picard, Jean-Luc, being willing to go back into the collective and tell him, even if you won't leave, I'll be with you to the end. Mm-hmm. And that sacrifice, that love is what makes Jack realize what I've been searching for my entire life is this. And the beauty of that is that Picard himself, Jean-Luc himself, would never have been able to make those statements unless he had been through what we went through in season two, right? And so there's a real beauty in the way in which this specifically, you know, Metallus was a part of season two. Mm-hmm. And so being able to see those connections, I think, really is nice. I think it's really well done.
So, yeah, Metallus was involved with season two, and Q was the catalyst for that story. And I believe that Metallus has said now, after the final episode of the series has aired, that he had this idea for Q's reappearance at the end of season three, back when he was working on season two. And knowing that, do you think, so everything that Jean-Luc goes through in season two, I think was very important for the character, so that Jean-Luc comes out the other side having healed from the past, from his childhood, what happened with his mother, things that were used to explain why he was kind of a loner, standoffish from the crew, could not form this relationship with Beverly and all of this. But on a different level, do you think that Q put Picard through that trial to prepare him to save Jack?
I like that a lot. I think that really makes these two seasons feel even more cohesive in that way. I think that's a phenomenal thought, Chris. And
I'm not sure if that's the intention.
Sure. Even if it isn't, even if it's just an unintended consequence, though, I think that's one of those things where you put the story out there, and then fans are able to make those connections. And I think 100%, I think that's a fantastic way to be able to, as a fan, bring these seasons into your mind. And we've got some ways in which I think this also connects with season one, and specifically does some things to try and, you know, ameliorate or even make better some of the stuff we saw there. Mm-hmm. But no, I think that's, you know, fantastic. Yeah. So
I was just thinking about it when Q appeared at the end of the episode and looks younger than the last time we saw him, where he faded away.
Right.
He died. And he does tell Jack that he thought that maybe Jack wouldn't think so linearly. And then I start thinking about, well, okay, so Q can just jump through time. We've seen him do it before. So the idea of Q dying for me was kind of odd. And if I just think about what the Q are. And so it could be that as a Q, time doesn't have the same meaning for him, right?
So, of course.
So he could jump, and he could put Picard through some sort of trial like this for something that is going to happen later on the timeline for Jean-Luc.
Yeah.
It works okay for this overall Star Trek story, I think, for me.
Well, I mean, and I had no problem with the Q thing because, again, Q is a being who is not bound by space and time. So there's no reason why, quote unquote, a younger version of Q couldn't be influenced, you know. So, again, stop thinking so three-dimensionally. You know, you have to think four-dimensionally when it comes to the Q. And time is a dimension for them, and it means nothing. And so, seeing fans get frustrated about that. I thought that what Metallus is trying to do there with connecting with a counter and far point and connecting with, you know, now. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, where better to end than at the beginning. And, you know, it just actually, I think, creates more of a fun jumping off point for a Star Trek Legacy series. So bringing Q back and having that connect with what you were talking about with season two, I think all makes this fit even better with the lens that you put on it. So
Talking about the spinoff series, since we're right at that point with Q, before Q appears, we've already got the approach to the Titan, and then we see that it's been rechristened the Enterprise G. And then we know Jack's being assigned to that ship. Then we have the scene on the bridge. We know that Seven's been promoted to captain. And then we see Jack, Seven, and Raffi. And already you're feeling like not only are they saying we might do a spinoff, we're starting it right now. We're going to take off, and there's going to be a new series. You feel like that. And then you get after you think that the episode has fully ended, because I'm sure most viewers felt this way, thought that the poker scene was the end of everything we were going to see on screen, because it goes on and on. It mirrors the end of All Good Things. And then there's this little coda at the end where Q appears, and it felt like one more push, like studio, we're going to do a spinoff. And now we're just going to say, hey, Jack, you've got a lot of adventures ahead of you. And I was thinking that if they don't do this series, I was flashing back to March of 1990 when Gordon Shumway looks up at that light from that spaceship, and then Alf ends on a cliffhanger and the show is canceled.
It all comes back to Alf.
It all comes back to Alf, and the show is canceled, and the writers, they tried to force the hand of the studio there. Give us more. Let us make more. And it didn't happen. And this coda with Q felt a little bit like, studio, just in case we didn't leave viewers wanting more and needing to let them know what happened, here's one more push for you.
Yeah. No, I agree with you.
It better happen. Yeah. Otherwise, I'm going to get ALF'd twice in my lifetime.
Yep. No, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. I think it's the perfect push. I wanted to talk a little bit with you, Chris, about we mentioned last week about how if this was not the end of the Borg, then this story would have seemed to be for naught. But really, this is their future's end. It has come. And so what did you think about finally bringing the Borg as this iteration? You know, we know the Dorati Borg are out there. So how did you feel about finally bringing them and finally getting to see their future's end?
Well, I was glad to see that I was correct last week when I said that the title, The Last Generation, refers to the Borg, not the humans, which it actually has layers. You can make it apply to the others as well. But I do think that it was largely a reference to what happens to the Borg, that it is the last generation of the Borg because they're not going to regenerate again. I thought that what they did with the Borg here was interesting. I wanted them to do something different, so I'm glad that it wasn't a fully functional Borg cube that had come to conquer Earth, one more attempt to conquer Earth, but rather they picked up on what happened at the end of Voyager. And before this episode aired, I actually went back and I watched Endgame because it had been years since I last watched it, and I wanted to refresh my memory a little bit on what Janeway does and how the Borg are left at the end of that. And I think that Metallus did a good job of picking up on that and then adding the time that would have passed since then and giving us Borg that were not able, like Janeway didn't completely destroy them. She didn't kill the Borg Queen, but she left the Borg Queen in a very weak state where we've been talking about families, parents, children, and all. This is a case where the Borg Queen has lost her children. So she's just there alone. She's having to cannibalize what remains of her drones.
I was about to say,
stay alive.
She's not just lost them. She's also been cannibalizing them so she can stay alive. So,
right.
Great parenting.
Yeah, I thought the portrayal of the Borg here, I think it was important to have a weakened Borg because if it was a full strength Borg queen and Borg cube that came through and they fully control the fleet, it would have been a little bit difficult to see how the TNG crew and the Enterprise D would save everybody in a way that's believable.
Right.
And I do have questions about how the Borg Queen and the Changelings came to work together and how all that played out. And I'm a little bit disappointed that we didn't get a little more resolution to that. I suppose that it'll be something that can be explored in novels, and all of our friends who write the wonderful novels can flesh that out in a way that will be very interesting.
Yeah, I think that on that specifically, I think the way that they did this and the way that you were kind of going down that road about, you know, the fact that Janeway did a number on the Borg in Endgame and, you know, with the Queen basically being left alone, she has very few drones left, literally very few drones left. It makes sense that she would have to find a partner for this. And when Jack reaches out to her, and we don't know exactly when that was, but it sparks in her the realization that this plan could actually come to fruition. And so I also appreciate about this, because I was thinking about in my mind in the ways in which this actually makes sense, that they would have specifically set up Federation Day and the ships that were going to be involved there to ships that they had been targeting, that they wouldn't have been able to try to assimilate all of Starfleet. I saw people complaining, you know, why is, you know, why is not Space Dock, you know, completely part of the Borg already? And so it's like, there, because there's like limited time and limited resources, it makes sense that this plan is good, but there are some flaws in the plan because, well, the Borg Queen is not at her full strength. The Borg are not at their full strength. And these changelings, there are only so many of them. So therefore, what they've been able to do almost works, right? It's just the fact that Picard is able to reach his son that breaks this connection. Because you put all your chips in one place, if you can get that chip out, the rest, you know, the Jenga blocks fall. And so I actually really like the way that this all connects. And I think it's really interesting. And I don't really think there are many quote unquote plot holes in all of this. It just like, We just don't get necessarily all the details, but I personally feel like I have everything I need to be satisfied with the story. And in all honesty, the more I think about it, the more I can see why the plan works out the way it does on the Borg and Changeling side, and then on the other side, because they don't have the infinite resources that they used to have. And so this plan is, you know, again, it's like a teetering Jenga board, and It can go one way or the other. And everything basically has to go perfect for the Borg and the Changelings at this point. And of course, you know, we know there are always possibilities, especially when it comes to the crew of the Enterprise. And I thought that this was a great way to finally get rid of the Borg, bring it all home satisfyingly. And then, of course, you know, have Admiral Crusher be able to spearhead the technology now to make sure that we eradicate this threat from everyone who's infected, and also be able to more adequately screen for changeling infiltrators, like the I'm sure not just, you know, our everyday run of the mill Great Link changelings, but these changelings that may still be out there.
Well, that's the thing, because to conclude this story in a satisfying way, you need to address not only the Borg Queen, but the changelings that had infiltrated Starfleet. And it can't be a big part of the story because You've got other stuff you got to deal with. So I like that they did just throw in that one little bit about the fact that Beverly had created a way to screen. And so it's just saying that, yeah, we're going to find all those changelings. We're going to get rid of them as well. We're going to clean the house and move forward from day one here, without it having to be explained and without them having to go on a hunt or anything like that.
You know, the beauty of that is that you've already kind of set up the fact that this would be possible because Crusher did intensive study here in the season about these changelings to kind of figure them out, you know, so they have a few different ways now for her to be able to you basically put the code in transporter wise across the fleet to look for, you know, the molecule that was used that has that half-life. How easy would it be able to figure that out now? Because that's not something you could hide as a changeling. So, I mean, To me, again, the beauty of this is, like you said, we're picking up on every single Borg story and we're bringing this to a close. We're finishing it out. It's done. And I think, you know, because that's the case, I'm satisfied with this being the Borg and finally putting the Borg to bed.
Bye-bye, Borgie. I do hope this truly is the end of the Borg and that they resist the temptation to use the Jurati Borg to somehow bring Borg back into Star Trek stories again. Because
We don't need that.
Really, time to move on from the Borg, I feel. The Borg were really interesting in The Next Generation. First Contact, fantastic movie. But as Voyager went on, the Borg became less and less interesting as they became more and more like another villain that you can work with, negotiate with, who's always pursuing Starfleet and all. And I think that what we got in this season was an effective way to put them to bed because it tied back directly into Jean-Luc's history with them and the experience of the whole TNG crew. And these are the characters that should write the final chapter for the Borg, because they're the ones who were there when the first chapter was written.
Right.
And which I do hope that this will be the end of it.
And that's why, of course, Seven needs to be a part of the story. And that's that, I think, legitimizing her being here makes so much sense. Which, speaking of Seven, what did you think of the story of them retaking the Titan and the way in which they're able to use the cloaking device that we've got and all of these type of things to be able to enact enough of a resistance to kind of keep the Borg from being able to destroy the starbase even quicker?
I thought it was great. I mean, it's what I would expect from Seven's character. Jeri Ryan played it wonderfully. I think it reflects the time that Seven spent in the Delta Quadrant on a ship that was outmanned and often in danger with no support. I think it reflects the influence that Janeway had on Seven, because
that's a good point.
She has that toughness that Janeway had in the face of danger and make a decision and do so in a caring way as well. I think you see how Seven talks to the cook who has to be the pilot, and she orders him to your station, but she also listens to him and she also encourages him a bit, like, you know, you can do this. And I think that's how Janeway nurtured her crew. So I think I see a lot of Janeway's influence in Seven. And I think that if you go back and you look at Seven through the Voyager series and how she grows, and then what we've seen of her so far in Picard, it makes perfect sense for her to become a captain, because she has that special quality that captains have that other officers don't necessarily. It doesn't mean other officers don't have great qualities, but there's just something about people who rise up to be a captain that's different. And you see that in Kirk, and the fact that Kirk rises to admiral, but it's actually as a captain where he can contribute the most to Starfleet. And I see that in Seven. And so I think she's going to be a wonderful captain. And the final redemption, I said last time that I wanted Shaw to have a little bit more of a redemption moment than what we got in the previous episode. And then we did get that here, where we find out what is said in the log that we had been seeing redacted in the final credits all season. We finally get to see that. And what I love about it is that he recorded that log before all this big adventure happened.
Right.
And so even then, he felt this about her, even though he was not yet willing to say it to her face.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, it was super fun. Coming up with I think maybe one of the most technobabble parts of the season, which is that their phasers could transport.
I thought that was cool. I thought that was like, wow, that's a clever solution to a problem and to avoid harming your young crew members.
I thought it was great. The idea that you would be able to do that, of course, you know, using the prefix codes to be able to scramble the shields of the fleet. Mm-hmm. That was, I mean, great callback there. And I thought all of that was wonderful. And I couldn't agree with you more. You know, this whole season has really been about building on everything that we got with Seven in the second season and capitalizing on that to move her towards the captaincy here. And I thought that, like you said, everything about this character, this season, the way that she has stepped up in all the ways that she has, have shown that she's absolutely captain material. Like, she should be a captain. At the same time, I think, and this is one of the things I thought really connected well, and I think I was reading this in an article with Matalas talking about, you know, he really wanted to utilize the character of Rafi and move that character forward, and in some ways kind of redeem that character from the past that she has had. And so I appreciate, you know, now she's the first officer. He mentioned, too, taking away their relationship allows them then to be on the same ship, because, you know, having that type of relationship with a first officer and a captain is kind of frowned upon, very much so, in Starfleet. Mm-hmm. And so this allows both of these characters to be the best version of themselves in a way that they necessarily couldn't be in a relationship together, mm-hmm. because it would keep them from being able to serve together. So I just, all of that I thought was really beautiful. And, you know, I love the idea of the cook flying the ship and being a part of this, because it reminded me of The Hunt for October, where, you know, you've got the cook who's responsible at the end of mm-hmm. almost, you know, starting nuclear war. But here it's the cook who may or may not know how to pilot, really. And I thought that was great.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, all of that was fantastic. I mean, just, I thought we really do such a great job. And of course, you know, mm-hmm. it's time and money that doesn't allow for us to have Janeway do the handoff.
Well, that's the thing, right? Yeah, I wanted to mention that. Like, last time we thought it's very likely that Janeway would appear at the end. And I was disappointed when that didn't happen. And then it turns out that, yeah, in an earlier version of the script, Metallus actually did have Janeway being there to promote Seven to captain, which would have been perfect. And I really wish they had found a way to do that. Apparently, budget didn't allow. But
yeah.
I think Tuvok and Seven works mm-hmm. because they had a relationship, a kind of a nurturing relationship aboard Voyager themselves. But given like everything I just said about Janeway's influence on who Seven has become, it really would have been ideal if Janeway could have been the one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think there is something special about it being Tuvok, because they also have a really key relationship. And to just to watch him push across the projector to her and everything mm-hmm. about that, I thought was really nice. And so one of the things, you know, we've talked a lot about on this episode, the past and, you know, of course, the idea that the past matters, names matter. And I thought that, you know, one of the things I just wanted to hit on really quickly is that the past of this works from many different levels, right, in this season. And one is that the past of Star Trek matters. And I think that Metallus and the writers here, they've lovingly crafted something that completely respects and honors all of Star Trek that we've seen in the 24th century and from Enterprise, TOS, and at the same time, lovingly move Star Trek forward. And fans love this. We love when we are respected, when what we care about is respected, because the past does matter. I mean, you know, the beauty of having the warp of the Enterprise D look like the old school warp,
mm-hmm.
the fact that, you know, like you said, Anton Chekhov, we're honoring Anton who died and naming this character then, and, you know, for him. Beautiful. The Riker maneuver coming out, putting up his leg on something, mm-hmm. the Picard maneuver, all of these things, right? And this series is rife with this stuff. But this season is also about the idea that the past is important for us to remember, because it's only by knowing the truth of the past that we can make a better future. And this season is all about what we leave behind and how we've lived, because it's what lays the foundation for what's to come. And there's something so beautiful in that, because then you cap all of this off by saying, yes, names mean something, because these things become symbols of what we hold most dear and are worth remembering. It's the reason why every civilization puts up monuments to important things, because mm-hmm. we need to be reminded, right? And so I was just really blown away by the way in which this theme came across so beautifully in this episode, and I think worked to, in all honesty, absolute perfection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, absolutely. And capped off by us getting the Enterprise back, because names
yep.
mean
yep.
almost everything.
Yeah. I do have to ask you, because there's a lot of fun things that happen as we escape the cube. Mm-hmm. And what did you think about some very fun revelations that we get from characters? And just there's just so much that happens there that I just loved.
Yeah. The whole cube sequence was it was interesting to me. I guess one thing I want to ask you about related to that is, how do you feel about the Enterprise D flying as it did through the inside of a Borg cube? Mm-hmm. First of all, they do the classic Star Wars Death Star. You got to fly to the middle and blow up something, and then you got to escape.
Sure.
But I don't know. I'm trying to think how I feel about it, because it was fun to watch the Enterprise D, but I feel a little bit weird seeing the Enterprise D fly like a ship in a video game, because it just doesn't feel like that's how that ship flies. But this is something that we've seen more often mm-hmm. in modern Star Trek. Sure. We see it in Strange New Worlds also, where the 1701, no bloody A, B, C, D, E, F, or G, is flying like it's in a video game. How do you feel about that?
So I think that I don't really have an issue with it because, mm-hmm. you know, this makes sense, right? These ships are in space. There's no resistance. And so to be able to turn on a dime like this, and especially with Data at the helm, who is mm-hmm. able to compute a massive amount of data per second, right?
And do it by gut now.
Yeah. So I think that part is something that makes complete sense to me. I have no issues with that, mm-hmm. honestly. And, you know, in all honesty here, Metallus is definitely using the finale of Return of the Jedi as his basis for how this story plays out. It's structured similarly in the sense that we have three different storylines going that we intercut between, and all of them are dependent on each other working. So Metallus is absolutely riffing on Return of the Jedi, which again, I have no problems with, because I think he pulls it off well. And I think the flight of the Enterprise D, I think the beauty of it is that it actually made the Enterprise D a better ship, because we were mm-hmm. able to see it not be such a lumbering thing. And I think that's something true. That, you know, that unfortunately, I believe that the Enterprise D has always kind of suffered from, because, of course, that's all that they could do at the time. And that wasn't their fault. It's just that was the reality of
it was a TV show and they were shooting a model. So
exactly. So you just didn't have that ability. And of course, I mean, Voyager changed a lot of this, you know, with using more and more CGI and what the ships could do. Mm-hmm. So I think it works really well. And I thought it was really fun and I didn't really have an issue with it. And goodness, mm-hmm. wow, a lot has happened in 20 years for Beverly. So,
yeah. She was, but you had a feeling that was coming up.
Yes.
From the very beginning, when we see her using the rifle at the beginning of the season.
And it was great. And I mean, is she better at tactical than Worf now?
Maybe, at least on the D, because Worf prefers the weapon systems on
the
E.
Yes, he does. Yeah, he really does. Yeah.
Speaking of Worf, I love one of the best moments, I think, of the episode is Worf falling asleep in the chair when they get back, because it's like, I've used all my energy, all my warrior energy, and just start snoring there at the end. Yeah.
Well, and, you know, swords are fun, as we've mentioned. Yeah. So, I thought that really worked. Just the interplay between him and Riker was perfect in this episode. And it felt right that it was those two along with Picard doing this together. Mm-hmm. Their scene together was so emotional as he's telling them goodbye. And, you know, it's a little bit different for each character, but it fit perfectly with who these characters are to one another. Mm-hmm. So I thought, you know, the way Metallus used the characters for this final episode was perfection, because then to have Troy be able to very Nemesis-like know where they are and then fly the D, not crash it this time, which is redemption for her for in the fans' eyes, right? Because so many people have complained about that.
And you know that that was an intentional reference, exactly. I think, was to give her that moment to fly the ship. Yeah.
Yep. So I think...
And she does a great job. I mean, the visuals of the Enterprise D coming close to people inside the cube, like flying up to them and stopping and going.
It was...
That was a very striking visual that... Yep. I'm talking about how I'm not sure how I feel about the Enterprise D flying like it's in a video game. But another visual that was unusual, but very striking, was that where, you know, she's pulling up to people and we're getting that perspective of looking up and seeing this gigantic ship.
It was awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought it was, I mean, again, all of that was just so fantastic. And I think it leads us into, you know, the ending of this series is very reminiscent of Return of the King, where we have a few different endings. And I love that because, again, it's about the legacy then. We're leaving space to show the legacy of what's happened. And one of the things that, you know, we talked a little bit about Rafi, but I thought it was really moving to have Worf help Rafi's family know exactly what she's done to keep the Federation safe, which... I think was a beautiful reminder actually to all of us that there are people who do this for us in the real world who never get to talk about how they've saved the world, right? And again, it's a beautiful redemption for this character who has struggled so much in this series, but now finally has completely firm footing. She has her family back. She has a new family on the Enterprise G, and it's... What a great way to kind of bring that character there full circle and really pay her homage. So,
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I you talked earlier about redeeming Rafi, and when we first meet her, we see she's down and out, and we've watched her struggle with her family throughout these seasons, but to bring it all back to this at the end, plus, as we talked about a little earlier, being on the bridge of the Enterprise G as the first officer, she's got that, she's got her family back, she's going to see her granddaughter. It all comes back for her, and it was wonderful to see Worf do that for her, because Worf is someone, I know fans like to make jokes about him and Alexander, but overall, I feel like Worf is a character for whom family is very important.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I agree.
The houses are very important. Here he calls her warrior of the House of Musiker, right, is how he refers to Raffaella, and he always uses her full name as well.
Yeah, I 100% agree on that. And I do have to ask you, obviously, this season, right? We transitioned the Titan A to the Enterprise G. And how do you feel about the fact that this ship is now known as the Enterprise and in many ways is a different type of thing in the sense that, you know, most of the Enterprise tend to be state-of-the-art and bigger and all those kind of things. Does this work for you to make this the G?
For me, it makes perfect sense because the Titan A is a Constitution III class ship, a Neo-Constitution class, as they also call it. And it just takes us back to the fact that the Enterprise was a Constitution class ship. So it makes perfect sense to me that we would, as we're bringing things to a close and opening new doors, but we're reflecting on the importance of history and events and relationships in life. It makes sense for me that for Starfleet, they would bring this back full circle as well, to where a class of ship that's a Constitution class would get the name Enterprise.
Yeah, I don't think it's strange for me to say that I was not necessarily a huge fan of the Titan when the show started.
Right. Yeah, you said that when we talked.
But this ship has really grown on me in a way that I didn't expect it to. And in all honesty, I've come to love this ship. And so for it to be the next Enterprise, I think is great. It's 100,000 times better than the Enterprise F ever was. So I'm very happy that this is the next Enterprise. And the fact that, I mean, when you think about then too, now that 7 of 9 is captain of the Enterprise G, mm-hmm. with Picard's son on it, you know, Geordi's daughter. And what I'm really wanting, not only am I wanting the series legacy now because I want to see these characters, but I want the series legacy because now I want to see the ship in fullness. I want to see the crew lounge. I want to see
the engineering.
I want to see all these things that we didn't get a chance to see because obviously I know it, you know, it's money and they spent a lot of money and they knew they were going to be bringing back the Enterprise D and the bridge there. And that was going to cost a lot there. So you understand why this, you know, they couldn't do that. And again, it's about storytelling and all those type of things. So I loved it.
You know, we talked on here about mid-season probably about how we wish we could see more parts of the ship and why can't we see engineering? And at that point, we didn't know we were going to spend all this time on the Enterprise D.
Right.
In retrospect, you can see budget had to go to rebuilding the D and they did it in such painstaking, loving detail. You know, that cost a lot. And it's a real shame that they then disassembled that bridge. I wish they could have built it in a way where it could have been transported and at least reassembled as some sort of museum piece.
Exactly. It should have been. I'm surprised that the, you know, it seems like to me, if you're the studio, why not keep that? So that, you know, you can turn it into a tourist attraction and make some serious bucks off of it. But anyway.
You could. Can you imagine if the Smithsonian had the Enterprise D bridge in there as well?
It'd be amazing. you know, the other thing about, and we are going to be wrapping up here soon, but I loved the way this ends with the TNG cast spending a lot of time together, shutting down 10 Forward Avenue night after night because they're back together. And it's almost like they don't want to let that go. The idea that, you know, Riker and Troy are planning a vacation because they're reconnecting and just, of course, ending with poker, I thought was beautiful because this time we know they're going to stay together. They're not going to be apart from one another. And I'm, you know, kind of hoping this finally means that Beverly and Jean-Luc are actually a couple now.
You don't think they're all going to move to Orlando together and get a timeshare, right?
You know, I don't know. that's an interesting thought. It seems like that they could all do that and then, you know, they could share it back and forth when they need to and everything. But, you know, it's not bad. But I just, again, the ending to this in that way was just so poignant and so fun and just leaves you with joy. And say what you will, leaving fans with joy for whatever they're watching, I think, is something that we have so little of these days. And I was absolutely, you know, adoring the ending. I just where we left is it makes me feel happy. Every time I've watched it, and I think I've seen the episode 3 times now, every time I've watched it, I've just come away with a big stupid grin on my face, which is exactly what you want with this cast, with this crew.
Yeah. And it's exactly the opposite of how I felt at the end of ALF.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I was disappointed, though, that Data left us hanging here with his final toast. There was a young lady from Venus.
Was great.
I loved that they fit that callback in also, and that they also left it hanging, and everyone's reaction to it was fantastic.
Yeah, it was wonderful. And so, you know, maybe we'll, maybe we'll do an episode of the show where we just kind of like give overall thoughts on the season and all that, you know.
Yeah,
but I feel like it's a, it is a perfect time, Chris, to just ask you what you are going to rate The Last Generation.
Yeah, Matthew, I think I'm just going to give this episode 45 minutes of rolling camera because that's how they filmed the final poker scene. And I would love to just see the entire shot. But I think that that was a wonderful way to do it, because the thing about that final poker scene is that you can tell that it's the cast just having a blast together, reliving that moment that closed out all good things. And it's such a real and authentic ending to this season and this series and the story of these characters. And the color of it, the lighting, everything about it, it's beautiful. So that's my rating, 45 minutes of rolling camera.
Nice. I'm going to give this season every single prefix code for the Frontier Day fleet, because I loved this. And there were so many moments where I was actually moved to actual tears watching it, especially the first time with some of the emotion that you get. And, you know, it's what's amazing is how they were able to capture the magic.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so hard to do. And so 100%, I mean, just loved it. I mean, you know, I don't know what else there is to say. Loved it.
Loved it. Well, everyone, we would love to hear if you loved The Last Generation and Picard Season 3. There are many ways for you to share your thoughts with us. Perhaps the best way is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That is our listeners group. It's there to extend the conversation beyond the podcasts, so it is a closed group just for listeners. And if you're joining for the first time, please do answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. There's just two simple questions there, and you can join into the discussion. You'll find a post on the timeline for this episode of The Artificial Tango, and you can share your comments and your thoughts there with Matthew and me and fellow listeners. And keep the conversation going. We've had some good chats there as Season 3 has wound down. And if you need to find it on Facebook, just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field, and it should come right up. If not, type the whole name, The Babel Conference. If you'd like to send us email, you can do that by going to our website, trek.fm/contact. Use the form you find there, choose to send to a show, and choose The Artificial Tango. And that message will dance its way right over to Matthew and me by email. You can also find us in social media. Our username everywhere is TrekFM. And if your podcast app of choice allows you to leave a rating and a review, we'd love to get that from you as well. Hear your thoughts on the show. And if you'd like to help us keep The Artificial Tango, because we will have more episodes after this, if you'd like to help us keep this show and everything that we're doing on the network going, we could definitely use your help. To find out how to get involved, how to support us, please visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. And I want to send a huge thank you to everyone who's supporting us right now. We would not be here without your help. Now, Matthew, when you're not making it a threesome, where can people find you?
Do you hear yourself? You know, I can be found all over the place on social media, named MattRushing02. Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, and Vero are the places I'm most active. Please follow me. I'd love to talk to you and hang out with you there. You can also find me here on the network in the 602 Club, where we're talking all of the fandoms outside of Star Trek that we love. Hope you'll join us there. We've got some great bonus shows in the feed as well that you can check out. So hopefully you will check all of them out. doing literary treks about the books and the comics of Star Trek. Chris, you and I do The Orb about Star Trek Deep Space Nine and our 30th anniversary rewatch there. Warp 5 and our 20th anniversary rewatch of Star Trek Enterprise there. We've got Saddle Up about Strange New Worlds. It's coming back soon. We're so excited. We're going to have more stuff here in the Artificial Tango and other things as well. So hopefully everybody checks all of that out. And then on the Nerd Party Network, there's two shows they have. Owlpost about Harry Potter and every single chapter of that series. And Aggressive Negotiations as we talk about Star Wars each and every week, my good friend John Mills and I. But Chris, where can people find you?
Well, you can find me elsewhere on the network. As you mentioned, doing all of those shows with you. You can also find me in many episodes in the back catalog on a variety of shows. Larry Nemechek and I do The Ready Room from time to time. And you can also find me in social media. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C and Brian with a Y. That's my username everywhere. Twitter's where I'm most active. You can also find me on Mastodon on the Trekkies.social instance. And I'd love to chat with you in social media. Well, Matthew, it's been a blast talking about The Next Generation and The Last Generation with you this season on The Artificial Tango. And I'm looking forward to more Picard talk with you. Like you said a moment ago, maybe we'll do a recap of the season, kind of look back at everything as a whole. We're planning to go through season one and do some other things. So the dance has not ended.
Well, Chris, I can't wait to get to the rest of our conversations here, but thank you, everyone, so much for joining us on this journey. And as they always say, all good things